Right now, in early 2026, aviation maintenance companies are doing something that, well, it sounds completely absurd on its face.
Oh, absolutely. It really does.
Right. Like, they are paying absolute premiums, sometimes double or triple the hourly rate, to rehire the exact same veteran engineers they effectively forced into early retirement. And this was just, what, 4 or 5 years ago during the pandemic?
Yeah, that's right. It's wild to see it play out.
It is. So, welcome to a custom tailored deep dive, where our mission today is to explore this massive, entirely invisible crisis that's currently tearing through the aviation industry.
And it really is invisible to the public.
Totally. We are looking at a structural collapse and how massive organizations function behind the scenes. Mm. But, you know, the structure that collapsed wasn't made of steel or concrete. It was made of institutional memory.
Which is so much harder to rebuild.
Exactly. We're going to extract crucial lessons about how organizations basically lose their minds and how you, sitting right there listening to this, might be experiencing this exact same invisible hollowing out in your own field without even realizing it.
I mean, it is the absolute definition of a quiet catastrophe, because if you walk into a hangar today, the planes look exactly the same.
Right. The shiny metal is still there.
Yeah. The testing equipment is all there. The lights are on. But the internal architecture of how these places actually work, you know, how decisions are made and how problems are actually solved, that has been completely hollowed out.
We really need to set the stage here with a reality check for everyone listening, because we are currently sitting in early 2026. Let's rewind the clock back a bit to 2020 and 2021.
Right, the peak of the COVID disruptions.
Exactly. Global travel basically stopped. The aviation industry was just hemorrhaging cash at an unprecedented rate. So many of these MROs, the maintenance, repair, and overhaul organizations, they made a brutally financially driven choice.
They really had their backs against the wall.
They did. They looked at their payroll, saw that their older, highly experienced engineers and mechanics were sitting right at the top of the pay scale, and they just decided to push them into early retirement.
It was a survival tactic, pure and simple. And what's critical to understand about their mindset at the time is that, well, management wasn't completely oblivious.
You don't think they were just blind to it?
No, not entirely. They actually knew this was going to create massive operational friction down the line. I mean, they knew they were losing incredibly valuable people who understood the whole genetic history of these aircraft.
Right, but the money just wasn't there.
Exactly. The financial pressure was so immediate and so entirely crushing that they simply cleared the desks anyway.
They figured, hey, we'll deal with the consequences later. We'll survive today. And when the money starts flowing again, we'll figure out how to train up the new guys.
Yeah, the ultimate case of kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, here we are in 2026. Later has officially arrived, and the consequences are far, far worse than anyone anticipated.
Oh.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the immediate aftermath of those retirements didn't instantly set off alarm bells, did it?
No, it didn't. And that delayed reaction is exactly why this problem is so insidious. You mentioned the expectation that management would just deal with it later. Well, the expected operational bounce back just never happened.
It just flatlined.
Yeah. In the immediate aftermath, as flights started resuming and maintenance schedules ramped back up, there were these like whispers circulating through the industry.
What kind of whispers?
Well, companies were starting to complain that their new generation of engineers, the ones who were supposed to step up and seamlessly fill the shoes of the retired veterans, they just were not operating efficiently.
Interesting.
They were struggling, and they were struggling in ways that really didn't make sense on paper.
Right, because on paper, these new hires have the degrees, they have the certifications, they're smart kids, but they were missing something vital. And there's a very specific, almost informal word that gets thrown around in the industry to describe what was missing. The new generation simply didn't know the tricks.
Tricks. It's such a perfectly loaded word in this context.
It really is.
Because we aren't talking about magic, and we certainly aren't talking about cutting corners in a way that violates safety protocols or FAA regulations or anything like that.
No, definitely not safety hazards.
Right. In aviation maintenance, a trick is the culmination of decades of trial and error.
It's the micro efficiencies, right? Like the older engineers having applied these undocumented methods for years to make the operations just run smoothly.
Exactly.
It's knowing that if you tweak this one particular valve a certain way during a diagnostic sequence, it saves you 3 hours of redundant testing. It's the kind of thing that just isn't written down in any official documentation.
Let's really look at what a trick looks like in the real world, just to ground this. Imagine you are troubleshooting a complex hydraulic issue on a landing gear.
Okay, landing gear hydraulics, got it.
The manual might tell you to run a full system purge, which takes, say, 8 hours and requires 3 technicians to do safely.
Wow, 8 hours.
Right. But the veteran mechanic, the guy who has been doing this since 1995, he knows that on this specific airframe, if the pressure drops exactly at this one manifold, 99% of the time, it's just a tiny O-ring in a secondary bypass valve.
Oh, man. So he just checks that first.
Exactly. He skips the 8-hour purge, checks the O-ring, replaces it in 20 minutes, and the plane flies. That is a trick.
And initially, the MROs looked at this inefficiency like the new guy's taking 8 hours instead of 20 minutes, and they thought, well, this is temporary.
Yeah, they assumed it was just growing pains.
Right. The new generation would stumble for a bit, eventually catch up, figure out their own tricks, and start performing at that higher level.
That was the operating theory across the board. But the lingering hangover of that financial decision back in 2020 is that half a decade later, the situation hasn't improved at all.
Not even a little bit.
Barely. The efficiency gap is still massively wide. The new engineers are still running the 8-hour purge every single time.
Now, let me offer an analogy here. It's like relying entirely on a GPS to navigate a massive, complex city versus actually knowing the layout of the city.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Right. The GPS represents the official manuals. Yeah. It will get you from point A to point B. It is technically correct. But the veteran who has driven those streets for 30 years, they know the tricks.
They know the shortcuts.
Exactly. They know that if it's 4:00 p.m. on a Tuesday, the main highway is a parking lot, the GPS is straight up lying to you about the ETA, and you need to take this specific unmarked back alley to bypass the gridlock, the new guys only have the GPS.
That is exactly what's happening.
But I have to push back on this a little bit. We are talking about highly educated people here. We are talking about aerospace engineers and certified technicians. Surely, if someone has an engineering degree and a solid foundation, they can just figure out the layout of the city over 5 years. Why is this performance gap so incredibly persistent? Why haven't they developed their own tricks by now?
It's a perfectly logical question. And honestly, it's exactly the question management was screaming in conference rooms a couple of years ago. Like, why aren't they figuring it out?
Right. They're smart. They should get it.
But the answer is deceptively simple. The friction of unmentored troubleshooting is simply too high. You can have all the degrees in the world, you can be brilliant, but if the ecosystem of mentorship has been entirely eradicated, the practical application of that theory just hits a brick wall.
Because the mentors, the guys who knew the back alleys, were all given a cardboard box and a severance package.
Precisely. You essentially broke the chain of knowledge transmission. Developing a trick requires a foundation of deeply contextualized experience.
You need to see things break.
Right. You have to see a problem fail in 50 different ways before you intuitively recognize the pattern of the 51st failure. The veterans had already paid that tax. They had already spent the thousands of hours making mistakes and learning the physical nuances of the machinery.
And the new guys are having to pay that tax all over again, completely from scratch.
Exactly. And the industry simply doesn't have the time or the margins for them to pay that tax. Which brings us back to the sheer absurdity you mentioned at the top of the deep dive.
The backtracking.
Yes. The situation has become so dire, so completely unmanageable regarding turnaround times and efficiency, that MROs are now engaged in a massive backtracking operation. They are actively hunting down the very people they fired.
They are begging them to come back.
Yeah.
And they are paying a massive premium for it, right?
Massive. Sometimes unheard of hourly rates.
Yes. And they're bringing them back not to turn wrenches, not to do the physical labor, but specifically to act as mentors.
Just to stand there and point.
Literally. Just to walk around the hangars, look over the shoulders of the new hires, and say, hey, stop, don't do that, look at the O-ring. They realized that without the old guard, the new guard is effectively stranded in a sea of documentation without a compass.
It is the ultimate irony of short-term financial engineering. I mean, they paid these veterans to leave, they absorbed years of degraded productivity and delayed aircraft, and now they are paying exorbitant consulting fees to bring them back to teach the people who were supposed to be their cheaper replacements.
It's mind-blowing when you lay it all out like that. To truly understand what exactly was lost when those seasoned veterans walked out the door, we need to look at a brilliant framework presented in our source material that breaks down institutional memory.
Right, the three levels.
Yeah, it's often referred to as the three no's.
Yeah.
And this framework is something you can apply to literally any complex job in any industry. So let's look at the first layer of this framework.
So the first layer is what we define as know-how.
Know-how.
This is the absolute foundational layer of capability. If you work in aviation maintenance, know-how is the baseline codified knowledge required to interact with the aircraft, to inspect it, to modify it, and to legally and safely return it to service.
The reassuring part of this, like the one silver lining that probably gave management that initial false sense of confidence, is that know-how is highly learnable.
Very much so.
It is fundamentally democratic because it's written down. The industry runs on massive, highly regulated documentation. You have the heavy hitters, right? The CMM, the EMM, the SRM.
Component maintenance manuals, aircraft maintenance manuals.
Exactly. You add in the digital twins, the online compliance courses, the exhaustive engineering drawings, and you have a very robust objective library of know-how.
It is the step-by-step instruction manual for reality. It tells you to turn this specific fastener with exactly this much torque. It tells you to inspect this specific composite panel for this exact tolerance of delamination.
So it's very black and white.
Exactly. And generally speaking, a competent, newly graduated engineer can use these resources to successfully execute a task. This type of knowledge transfers relatively easily. You don't need a 30-year veteran to teach you how to read a torque spec from an AMM.
Let me bring this directly to you, listening right now. Think about your own career, whatever field you're in. Know-how is the stuff that takes up the bulk of your resume.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, it's your hard skills.
Yeah.
It's the software platforms you are certified in, the standard operating procedures you have memorized, the coding languages you can write. If a new hire shadowed you and asked how to do your daily tasks, you could probably point them to a wiki page, a handbook, or a set of training videos. That is your know-how.
And people are generally pretty good at acquiring that.
Right. The reality is most professionals master this layer without too much trouble.
What's fascinating here is that very mastery is exactly what creates a profound, systemic, false sense of security within an organization.
I love how you frame that, a false sense of security. Let's dig into that psychology a bit. Why is it dangerous that they are good at following the manual?
Because it creates an illusion of complete competence. Management looks down at the hangar floor, or they look at the metrics dashboard, and they see these new engineers pulling up the AMM, executing the tasks perfectly, signing off on the paperwork, and the planes are rolling out.
So it looks like everything is working perfectly.
Right. They see the know-how in action, and they assume the knowledge transfer is complete. They check the box and say, well, our workforce is trained.
It's almost like the Dunning-Kruger effect, but applied at an organizational level. The new engineer follows the GPS perfectly, arrives at the destination, and suddenly believes they understand the whole city. They feel a sense of mastery because the manual worked.
Exactly. But know-how on its own is entirely fragile.
Fragile how?
Well, it only works when the environment perfectly matches the parameters of the manual. The manual assumes a closed, perfect system. It assumes the part you are replacing exactly matches the schematic. It assumes the wiring harness hasn't been slightly chafed by 20 years of microscopic vibration.
Right. Knowing how to follow a manual is an entirely different cognitive process than understanding the invisible architecture behind that manual. When reality deviates from the printed page, even by one degree, know-how just collapses.
It completely falls apart.
Which leads us directly into the deep mystery. The second layer of institutional memory. This is the most critical, the most powerful, and honestly, the most fragile element of the entire system.
This is the know-why.
The know-why. These are the hidden secrets of the industry. Unlike the know-how, which is neatly bound in searchable PDFs and online courses, the know-why is almost entirely unwritten.
Almost never written down.
It is stored exclusively in the biological hard drives of the people who built the systems.
Yeah.
Every single MRO, every engineering firm, every hospital has these secrets locked away in the minds of their most experienced people.
It is the rationale behind the rules. It's the genetic history of the constraints. Let's look at a highly specific, very technical example to really illustrate how deep this goes because it perfectly captures the terror of losing this knowledge.
Okay, lay it on me.
Let's talk about air and sea standards.
Yes, air and sea.
Yeah.
These are the documents that govern the technical standards and protocols for data communications and avionics across the entire global aviation industry. They are the bedrock rules of how planes talk to themselves and the rest of the world.
Right. And inside many of these ARINC documents governing different systems across different aircraft, there is a very specific, deeply embedded rule regarding aircraft power supplies.
Okay.
It dictates the tolerance for a power interruption. It's known as the 200 millisecond rule.
200 millisecond.
Yes. If the power to a critical system is interrupted, the system must be designed to ride out that interruption without failing or resetting for exactly 200 milliseconds.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because you have to look at that number and ask the fundamental engineering question, why 200?
Exactly.
Why not 100 milliseconds? Why not 300? From a purely physical electrical engineering standpoint, you absolutely can design a power supply with larger capacitors or different relay latches to maintain voltage for 300 milliseconds.
Yeah.
The physical capability exists.
Right, it's just hardware.
And you can just as easily save weight and cost by designing it to ride out only 100 milliseconds. So why, across decades of crucial documents, was the number 200 chosen? Who picked it?
And that question is the pure essence of know why. Try to find out for yourself. It is phenomenally difficult, bordering on impossible. You can search the ARNC standards, you can search the AMMs, you can look at the schematics.
And they just won't tell you.
No. They will all strictly enforce the 200 millisecond rule, but they will almost never explain why it is 200 milliseconds.
Because if the specific working group, or like the specific lead electrical engineer who made that decision 20 or 30 years ago during some random committee meeting in 1994, never bothered to write down their rationale.
Which they usually don't.
Right. If they never documented the intense debate they had about weight versus safety versus the spool down time of a specific legacy generator, that reasoning is gone. It evaporated the day they retired.
It's lost forever. And you might be sitting there thinking, well, so what? Who cares why it's 200? The rule is 200. Just follow the rule. Build it to 200 milliseconds and move on.
Exactly. If it works, don't fix it. Just treat it like a law of physics.
But treating it like a law of physics is exactly what kills innovation. And more importantly, it's what introduces catastrophic risk during modifications.
Oh, wow. Okay, explain that.
Well, losing that rationale is not just an academic exercise. It has massive real-world implications, especially when we talk about the life cycle of modern commercial aircraft. Let's extrapolate this out to the design of new systems, new LRUS line replaceable units, or entirely new modifications to legacy airframes.
Let's talk specifically about those legacy modifications, because this is where the rubber meets the runway. You look at the workhorses of the global fleet, right? The 737 MAX and the A320neo. These are heavily, fundamentally upgraded versions of older airframes.
Very older airframes.
Yeah, the original 737 flew in the 1960s, the original A320 in the late 1980s.
Precisely. Over the multi-decade lifespan of an aircraft program, there will inevitably be massive upgrades to improve fuel efficiency, avionics, and passenger capacity. You are essentially trying to graft 21st century technology onto a 20th century skeleton.
That sounds incredibly complicated.
It is. And during those upgrades, the new generation of design engineers, the ones who possess all the latest digital know-how, they will look at the old schematics of that 20th century skeleton, scratch their heads, and wonder why things were done in a particular, seemingly inefficient way.
They'll look at the blueprints and say, why is this wiring harness routed through this highly congested area instead of taking the shorter path? Or why is this structural spar reinforced with this specific heavy titanium alloy here when modern computer modeling says aluminum would hold the load?
Right. Or why is the power interruption tolerance exactly 200 milliseconds?
And if they don't have the know why, they are forced to make assumptions.
And assumptions in aviation are dangerous.
Seriously. They might assume that the 200 millisecond rule is just an arbitrary choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe an outdated limitation of 1980s capacitor technology that just no longer applies. They look at it through the lens of modern optimization and say, hey, we can save 3 pounds per aircraft if we drop the tolerance to 100 milliseconds. Our new modeling shows it's totally fine.
But what if that 200 millisecond rule wasn't arbitrary at all? What if it was actually tied to the precise mechanical spool down time of a critical hydraulic pump that, during a specific cascade failure scenario, takes exactly 150 milliseconds to switch to a backup bus?
Oh, geez.
If you drop the tolerance to 100 milliseconds because you wanted to optimize the system, and you didn't know the why behind the original constraint, you have just engineered a catastrophic failure into the airplane. Knowing the reason, knowing the why, is the invisible fence that keeps you from walking off a cliff.
You are modifying incredibly complex, highly interconnected systems without understanding their genetic history. It's like changing the code without reading the comments left by the original developers.
Exactly.
But the original developers didn't leave comments. They just held it in their heads. And if those developers were given early retirement packages during the COVID panic and they never took the time to write it down, you are flying completely blind.
It's terrifying when you really break down the mechanics of it. You have brilliant young engineers making structural and electrical decisions based on a partial picture of reality.
But let's play this out. Let's say a young engineer is sharp enough to realize this danger. Let's say they hit a wall, they look at the 200 millisecond rule, they look at their optimization plan, and they have a moment of clarity. They think, wait, I really need to find the no why for this before I change the design. There has to be a reason.
Okay, a best case scenario.
Right. Even if they have that revelation, they face another massive immediate hurdle. How do they even begin to look for it in an organization with 50,000 employees and decades of archives?
Which brings us to the third and final layer of our institutional memory framework. The third no is the nowhere. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It is exactly where can the information, the context, the no why actually be found.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here based on the source material.
Yeah.
Because we are sitting here in 2026. We're not digging through dusty filing cabinets in a basement anymore.
Yeah.
Everything is digitized. We live in the era of the cloud, of enterprise data lakes, of AI-assisted searching. The author even mentions that essential information is stored on computers, allowing keyword searches. So doesn't a digitized searchable database completely solve the nowhere problem? You have a question about the 200 meters rule. You just type 200 meters power interruption rationale, ARNC, into the search bar, hit enter, and read the PDF, right? Problem solved.
It is the most common and perhaps the most dangerous assumption in modern management. The assumption that the search bar is a substitute for the mental map.
That's all in there, isn't it?
The reality is that the search bar is often an illusion of accessibility. Because even with the most advanced enterprise keyword searches, digitized records, and data lakes, we still rely entirely on a highly limited number of human beings.
Walk me through the mechanics of that. If the document was scanned in 2005 and it's in the computer, well, it's in the computer. Why isn't that enough?
Because the computer has no context, and raw data is not knowledge. Let's go back to your young engineer searching for the 200 meters rule. They type in the keywords. The database returns 14,000 hits across 50 different projects spanning 30 years. Memos, meeting minutes, preliminary design reviews, discarded drafts, final schematics.
That's a lot of reading.
A raw database dump of a million PDFs is functionally useless if you don't know what you're actually looking for.
Oh, man. You're right. It's just noise.
Exactly. You need the human being who possesses the vital knowledge to know which keywords to actually use, which specific database or legacy folder structure to look in, and how to contextualize the search results when they finally appear.
So it's not just knowing the file name.
No. The knower isn't just a physical location or a URL link. It is the mental map of the organization's entire archive. It's the veteran systems engineer who you bump into in the break room, who listens to your problem and says, oh, you're looking for the power supply rationale. Don't bother searching the electrical engineering drives. It's not there. Look in the cross-departmental safety committee minutes from October 1998 under the project code Bluebird, because that's when the actual debate happened between us and the avionics guys.
That is so painfully true for anyone who has ever worked in a large corporation. The computer doesn't know that the debate happened under a secret project code in 1998. It only knows what you ask it. Oh. And if you don't possess the nowhere, you literally cannot even formulate the right question to ask the database.
You don't know what you don't know. And this highlights the extreme systemic danger of relying on a handful of human indexers, these veterans, who hold the mental map of the company. Because what happens when the person holding the map suddenly, without warning, departs the organization?
They just vanish. And people vanish from companies for all sorts of reasons. We've talked extensively about the COVID RAFs, the reductions in force that acted as a massive catalyst for this current crisis. We know about standard planned retirements. But the reality of running a business is that departures are often instantaneous.
It's the classic hit by a bus scenario that risk managers talk about, though our source frames it a bit more positively. What if your lead archivist, the guy who holds the entire mental map of the 737 modification history in his head, simply wins the lottery on a Tuesday night?
He walks in on Wednesday morning, drops his badge on the desk, says good luck, and is on a beach in Maui by Thursday.
Precisely. The departure is instantaneous, completely unpredictable, and absolute. And when he is gone, no one will know where his documents are. No one will understand his idiosyncratic folder structures. No one will know the context of why certain decisions were logged in certain ways. The map is gone.
And the cost of losing that map is catastrophic. There's a very stark reality here from the text. When an organization forgets its past, it is fundamentally doomed to repeat it. In the context of aerospace engineering, or any highly technical field, without the know-where, you cannot possibly find the know-why.
And if you can't find the know-why, you are doomed to redesign it.
You are doomed to reinvent a wheel that was already invented, heavily tested, intensely debated, and finalized by your own company 20 years ago.
Such a waste of resources.
Unbelievable waste. You have to spin up a new engineering team, run new simulations, build new physical prototypes, and run them through failure testing just to arrive at the exact same 200 millisecond rule that was already sitting in a forgotten folder. The sheer compounding waste of time, money, and human capital is staggering.
So let's synthesize this framework. The three knows know how, know why, and know where. Collectively, this is often referred to as tribal knowledge. And the fundamental, inescapable flaw of tribal knowledge is that it largely resides in biological systems. It lives in people's heads.
Now, relying on people's heads has always been a vulnerability in any business since the dawn of commerce. But the crisis we are seeing in 2026 isn't just about people retiring. It's about what happens when the demands on those heads suddenly, violently change due to massive, rapid technological shifts. Because the aviation industry isn't standing still while it tries to remember its past. The planes themselves are fundamentally changing.
This introduces a massive complicating factor into the equation, a phenomenon we can categorize as people obsolescence. And this battle against obsolescence is currently being fought on two highly distinct ongoing fronts.
Let's break down the first front, which is essentially a technological treadmill that is running faster and faster. If we look at line maintenance, the day-to-day work of keeping planes flying at the gate, it used to be a highly mechanical endeavor. It was literally turning wrenches, inspecting physical metal parts for stress, checking fluid levels, listening to the pitch of an engine. But that mechanical reality is rapidly disappearing.
Evolving technology has completely shifted the baseline cognitive requirement of the job. Evolving from physical linkages to fly-by-wire, from mechanical gauges to glass cockpits, from standalone hydraulics to deeply integrated digital networks. The increasing use of built-in tests, advanced onboard diagnostics, and complex operational software means that mechanics can no longer just be mechanically inclined.
They can't just be gearheads anymore.
Exactly. They must now be fully proficient in digital technologies. They have to know how to interface a ruggedized laptop with the aircraft's central computer brain. They have to understand how to run software diagnostics across a CAN bus network. They have to interpret complex, cascading digital hexadecimal error codes rather than just looking for a puddle of hydraulic fluid on the tarmac.
And here's where the friction of the tech treadmill really grinds the gears. You have your older generation, the veterans, who hold all the deep know-why about the physical systems. They know exactly how the landing gear works.
Right, they built it.
But they themselves might be profoundly struggling to keep up with the new digital know-how required just to plug the laptop into the plane to read the code. The tool set has passed them by. So that's front number one. The brutal struggle to keep individual skills relevant as the baseline technology evolves at breakneck speed.
And then, crashing directly into front number one, we hit the second front, the demographic cliff.
The aging workforce.
Yes. In many industrialized nations, across various heavy industries, and specifically within these highly specialized aviation companies, the workforce demographic is undeniably heavily skewed toward the older end of the spectrum. The critical knowledge that actually makes these organizations successful, that deep tribal know-why and the mental map of the nowhere, resides disproportionately with workers who are in their late 50s and 60s.
And here is the fatal systemic flaw. Too often, in massive corporations, there is absolutely no structured, funded, formalized method for transferring this knowledge to younger employees. None. Management just assumes it will happen organically.
They assume it will happen by osmosis. They think that simply putting a 25-year-old in the same hangar as a 60-year-old will somehow result in a telepathic transfer of 30 years of context.
But osmosis isn't a business strategy. It's a biological process that doesn't apply to engineering history. When those experienced workers retire or take a buyout during a pandemic or win the lottery, that context doesn't linger in the air. It literally walks out the door, gets in a car, and drives away forever.
And the loss of this knowledge doesn't just cause minor hiccups. It causes severe, paralyzing disruption. Organizations inevitably hit a crisis point where a vital, complex legacy task must be performed, say an emergency modification to a decades-old landing gear strut. And suddenly they look around the room and realize that not a single human being left in the building actually knows how to do it. Or, more importantly, why it was designed that way in the first place.
It's a slow-motion train wreck that suddenly goes at the speed of light.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is exactly why knowledge management isn't just some empty corporate buzzword pushed by consultants. True knowledge management is a survival imperative. It is the deliberate, funded, and systematic management of vital organizational knowledge. It requires active processes for its creation, its organization, its dissemination, and its practical exploitation.
Deliberate and systematic. Not accidental, not assumed, not left to chance. A key aspect of any successful operation must be the active capture of the knowledge residing within the minds of the employees before they leave. So here is where we stand in 2026. The MROs realize they have this massive existential crisis on their hands. They are bleeding no why and nowhere at an alarming rate. The demographic cliff is crumbling beneath them, and the new digital tech is compounding the confusion. So MROs realize they have this massive knowledge management crisis on their hands. How are they trying to fix it?
Well, this leads us to what is arguably the most tragicomic reality of the modern corporate world.
The fix it fails spectacularly. Enter the academics.
You look at what MROs and engineering firms are actually doing right now to solve this, and it is fascinating in its desperation. Well-intentioned managers, desperate to plug the knowledge drain and solve these complex operational gridlocks, are turning to academia.
Right.
They are looking at their workforce, seeing a massive intellectual deficit left by the departed mechanics, and deciding they need to go out and buy the biggest, most heavily credentialed brains on the open market. They're actively hiring massive cohorts of people with master science degrees, MSCs, and PhDs.
They are thinking, our systems are failing, our efficiency is tanking, we clearly need smarter people. Let's hire a team of PhDs in fluid dynamics and systems engineering, and their raw academic horsepower will somehow bridge the gap left by the guys who used to fix the planes.
Exactly. But there is a very sharp, very painful contrast between what these new, highly credentialed hires can do and what they fundamentally lack when they step onto the hangar floor. Well, these individuals are incredibly smart. They possess deep theoretical knowledge. They can deliver excellent data-rich presentations. They are fantastic at leading cross-functional meetings.
They can build an absolutely beautiful pivot table-heavy slide deck.
They know the pure theory of management and engineering, but they almost entirely lack the specialized, deeply ingrained, contextual, technical knowledge required to truly understand the granular physical problems happening on the line.
Right, the real world stuff.
They understand the physics of a hydraulic pump, sure, but they don't have the 20-year mental catalog of tricks required to know why this specific pump on this specific aircraft model vibrates at a certain frequency right before it fails.
So what does this all mean in practice? Let's paint the picture. You have a highly educated PhD sitting in a glass-walled conference room overlooking the hangar. They are tasked with solving an operational bottleneck they don't practically understand, trying to replace the cognitive output of a generation of grease-stained veterans who took the company's actual memory with them. It sounds like a recipe for total communication breakdown.
It is total gridlock. It's a clash of two entirely different epistemologies. And there is an ultimate, incredibly dark irony to this entire situation from our source. The managers hire these PhDs to fix the deeply complex problems holding up the maintenance lines. But because the foundational know-how, the contextual know-why, and the archival know-where have already been permanently lost to the COVID retirements.
Oh, no. I see where this is going.
Nobody left in the company can even provide a functionally correct description of the problem to the newly hired PhDs.
That is staggering. Let me repeat that, because that is the absolute core of the whole disaster. You spend millions of dollars to hire a certified genius to solve a complex puzzle, but because you fired the guys who built the puzzle, and you lost the picture on the front of the box, you can't even tell the genius what the puzzle is supposed to look like. You can't even define what's broken because you've lost the institutional memory of how the machine worked when it was whole.
You are completely adrift. The PhD asks, why does this system behave this way? And the 25-year-old line mechanic says, I don't know, the manual just says to replace it. And the loop of ignorance closes perfectly. This brings us to a very stark Very unsentimental financial bottom line.
Right, because we can't forget how this all started. This wasn't an accident. This all started with a deliberate financial decision in 2020. Save money today by cutting the most expensive payroll.
Yes. And the ultimate financial conclusion is brutal. It will take a very, very long time for these massive MROs to operate as efficiently, as safely, and as cost-effectively as they did before the COVID panic. In many cases, regarding specific legacy systems, these massive organizations are quite literally starting from scratch.
They're relearning how to walk.
They are paying the ultimate penalty for short-term thinking. Preserving knowledge is undoubtedly costly. It takes time. It takes dedicated software systems. It takes paying two people to do a job so one can mentor the other. But if you do not pay the cost to preserve it, you are doomed to start all over again.
And that's even worse.
And starting from scratch, reinventing every procedure, relearning every lost trick through painful trial and error, rediscovering every 200 millisecond rule the hard way through system failures, is infinitely more costly than the price of preserving it in the first place.
Talk about a penny-wise, pound-foolish strategy that backfired on an industry-wide scale. You saved a few million on payroll in 2020, and now you are losing tens of millions in 2026 because you can't get planes out of the hangar. Now, I won't bring this deep dive directly back to you, the listener, because while we spent a lot of time talking about aviation airframes and maintenance hangars, the core mechanics of what we've discussed are entirely universal.
It applies everywhere.
The incredible value of the individual and the deeply embedded undocumented knowledge within them is a reality in every single field. This value is fundamentally underestimated by management everywhere, and efforts to capture that knowledge are almost always implemented too late or not at all.
It's a universal blind spot in modern corporate philosophy. We are taught to assume that the system is greater than the people within it, that everyone is replaceable, but often the people are the system.
Exactly. So I want you to mentally walk through your own workplace right now. Your office, your remote team Slack channels, your hospital ward, your law firm. Who holds the know why in your organization? Who is that one specific person everyone quietly goes to when the official manual doesn't make sense, or when the million-dollar digital database search turns up empty?
And critical thinking requires actively questioning our assumptions about the safety nets we rely on. We naturally assume that a modernized, digitized database, with all its AI integration and keyword search capabilities, fully replaces the need for human mentorship and historical context. But the reality we've explored today proves that assumption is fundamentally dangerously flawed. The database is just the library. You still absolutely need the librarian who knows why the books were written and where they are hidden.
Absolutely. We spent a lot of time today unpacking that invisible 200 millisecond rule, a tiny, seemingly arbitrary detail that holds massive structural weight. But the reasoning for it is trapped in the past. It makes you wonder, in your own career, in your own daily workflows, what are the 200 millisecond rules that you follow every single day without having any idea why? Why is the quarterly report formatted this exact tedious way? Why do we use this specific clunky vendor despite their obvious flaws? And more importantly, if the person who created that rule or the person who holds the mental map to your department's entire archive won the lottery tomorrow and simply never came back, would your team be completely doomed to reinvent the wheel from scratch? Or do you actually have a deliberate system in place right now to capture their know-why before they walk out the door forever?
It is the defining difference between a resilient organization that can adapt to the future and one that is quietly, invisibly eroding from the inside out.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden mechanics of knowledge, memory, and the cost of forgetting. Keep asking the hard questions in your own work. Challenge the assumptions of your own systems. And always, always keep seeking out the why behind the how.